techniques may be the same as far as having to the discipline of that, but the technique is not the right word. I'll have to go to my thesaurus to find this, which I'm constantly doing. But anyway, I will write with pictures in my mind. Everything is visualized. I have an extremely active imagination. I'm a voyeur. I like to see everything. I'm the kind of fellow who likes to peek in your windows and see what's going on. If I come into your house, if you invite me in, I will go through your cabinets and I will open your drawers and I will. My wife says I'm nosy. She says, "Don't do that." We're staying with the Pavies. I've always already looked through all of their closets and all of their cabinets, and there's just a natural curiosity inside of me to do this. It's just the way I'm built. Others are very, very regimented in what they do. They have very little curiosity. They see things in outline form. I seldom see things in outline form. That's just where my approach is from. So even though we will approach it differently, the writing technique will be essentially the same, of having to find time and discipline yourself and use your research, which is what I do. Occasionally, I will use an outline. With this little book, I used an outline. I already knew ahead of time what my... I jotted down what my chapter headings were going to be. And then I worked inside of those. If I'm writing a story, I oftentimes will begin at the end, and I will have my conclusion before I have my introduction, because I know where I'm going, which is a type of outline, so that I know where I'm going to wind up. And especially with magazine work, where you're limited with the number of words that you can use. If you're using 1,500, 1,700 words, maybe 2,000 words, it's extremely important that you know where you're going. How that story is going to... We use a little phrase that we use in our magazine work called takeaway. And the thing that I'm always asking as an editor, if somebody else hands me a manuscript, I will ask them, what is the takeaway of the story? What is the one thing you're trying to say? Because in a magazine article, you never try to say more than one thing. The problem is that people try to say too many things. And so I try to know where I'm going, which is more important than the means that I will use to get there. Other writers, especially those who are doing different kinds of writing, must work from outlines, because they know that they must cover all of these different subjects to fully complete what they're doing. A storyteller will often not do that. A lot of folks are good storytellers, but they never have a point to their story. They never have a moral to their story. They just kind of ramble on and on and on. And when they finish, you say, "Well, that was interesting, but what did he say? What was the point that he was trying to make?" The writer always makes the point. Writing is not like artwork. Oftentimes, people will try to compare writing with painting. In painting, you take a big canvas and you put it up and you put a wash on it, and then you begin to paint your background and your mountains, and then you put your trees in, and then you paint your lake, and then you put your figures in it, and you're building all the time. Writing is not like that. Writing is not like painting. It's like sculpturing, where you take a huge block of material and you chip away everything that does not look like the one thing that you have. And so writers are deep, so you don't clutter up your material with all of this extraneous matter that you throw at people. The good writer is the person who knows how to say something in a very brief period of time, and he says it and puts the period at the end of the sentence. And there's very few folks who can do that, because we know so much and we want to tell everybody so much. One of the fortunate things about writers is that you're limited to space. You can only have so many pages that you can put this in, and so you have to chip away everything else that won't fit in. Yes, sir? Oh, I imitate all the time. I don't plagiarize. At least I try not. There's a difference in plagiarizing and imitating. Plagiarizing is when you take somebody's words and copy them and then say that you wrote them. And that's both illegal and immoral. But I imitate all the time. I love to take somebody else's style. I've been reading just recently an American humorist of this last century called James Thurber, who is one of the fine humorists, because I really believe that God is going to allow me to get over into the field of satire and humor in some of the writing that I want to do. I've played around with some of this, but it's a fine art to write in the area of humor, to get people to laugh at something and to make a point at the same time. So I've been studying Thurber, who has done some marvelous kind of things, and I want to imitate some of his style in what he does. John Sherrill tells a little story in the foreword of his book called They Speak With Other Tongues, in which he's telling about how he learned to speak in tongues, and he likens it. He has a rather lengthy simile in the foreword of the book of learning to sing bass in the choir in the Anglican church that he goes to. And he said he had joined the choir and he had never really sung parts. Has anybody ever read this story? Yeah, David, you had, two of you. Most folks don't read the forewords to books. They kind of skip over that. I wrote a foreword for David's book, which you will not read, so that you can get on to the real heart of that. But in the foreword to John's book, a little preface, the great story is right there at the very beginning. And he talks about the fellow who was in the choir, who was the good bass singer, who stood behind him and told John, he said, "Now, if you will lean up against me," he said, "put your back up against my chest." And he said, "while we're singing," and then he put his arm around him, and he said, "you will feel the vibrations coming from me into you." And he said, you'll pick this up by just being close to me. And something happens as those vibrations, the sound vibrations from the chest, are passed through the rib cage into the back and finally come out of your throat at the same time, until you're singing the same note that I'm singing as you do that. Good singers always do this. They listen to the person next to them and they imitate that note. I do this with my writing all the time. And if I reach what I call a writer's block, where nothing's happening, I'll pick up one of my favorite writers. John Sherrill is one of those, or Steinbeck, or some of the others. Or I'll read some of the American poets, Longfellow, or Whitman, or James Whitcomb Riley, some of the others. And I'll read them out loud. I sometimes will take down Thomas Gray's Elegy in a Country Churchyard, and I'll sit there at my desk, and I'll read this thing out loud to nobody. Or I'll pick up a passage from Hamlet or Macbeth and read it out loud. And as I do that, something sparks inside of me. I begin to pick up whatever writing spirit it was that they had, and I begin to imitate that. And then when I finally put words on paper, it doesn't sound like Thomas Gray at all. It sounds like Jamie Buckingham. But by the imitation, something has happened. And so I recommend that to you, by the way. To do that, and something will happen inside of you as you pick up the genius of others. Will begin to flow through you, and then when it comes out of you, it'll come out of you sounding like you, not like them. Amen. Experience. I think it's very difficult for a young writer to write out of his own experience. Therefore, I think the discipline of writing somebody else's stories is always a good way to start. Most of us have very limited experience. And if you try to write out of it, you quickly run out of experience, because especially if you're young. And so the good place to start is to polish your writing technique by writing the experiences of others. Everybody has a story, but most people cannot write it down. And so the great need in the writing field today is for somebody who can tell somebody else's story, who will recognize that, "My, that's a wonderful story," and say, "I can write that down." One of the things you can do is you can edit out a lot of the extraneous material that the other person wants to put in. And you can tell it from beginning to end, and you will see things that the other person will not see. And then after you have done this for a period of years, you begin to have your own experiences. And then later on in life, you begin writing your own things. I don't recommend that young writers start by writing out of their own experience. First of all, your experiences are rather shallow. Wait until you have gone through some of these things yourself. And in the meantime, write all of these other stories that need to be told of various people. That's not to say that a young writer cannot do that, but by and large, it's not a good idea to begin that way. I just had to live a long time and get kicked around a bit. Oh, when I was 42, 43, something like this. Yeah, it's younger all the time. The first two books that I wrote under my own name were books on sex education for children. Because we were raising small children at the time, and we were going through this whole thing with trying to educate them as to God's plan for their bodies and what their physical bodies were made up of, and they were asking questions, and we had a big flap going in the United States about sex education, that it was of the devil and many other things, that you should never talk about sex. And I said, well, if we continue to do this, well, we're going to have a generation where nobody reproduces. So there must be a good way to do this. And so I did. I wrote two small books, for pre-adolescent children, and then others for children who had just gone into their teen years, about what to expect in their bodies. And they were just stories that I was telling to my children. I was qualified to do that. Yeah, that's extremely important. Submission, which I think is one of the big words that God is always saying to His people, is perhaps more evident in the writing field, or perhaps in the theatrical field. Critics are extremely important to the dramatist. Otherwise, he just goes ahead and does his merry thing. But if you have critics out there who are constantly saying, that was no good, that was really bad, then after a while you begin to realize it probably wasn't any good and I shouldn't do that anymore, or I need to change it. And if nobody likes it, then don't continue to do it. And so it is with writing. And so I work constantly with editors at all different kinds of levels. I work with editors. I prefer to work with one book editor, and Len LeSeward has been, over the last several years, has been my book editor with my material. With A Way Through the Wilderness, we sat down for days at a time and went through this, and he marked it. And then in that particular case, I was working with a whole team of editors. Catherine Marshall went through that book and marked many passages which needed to be changed or revised, or pointed out that there were areas to where I had wandered and strayed. And so we work with a whole team, but basically I work with one editor. In the magazine work, I'm constantly working with editors. The only thing that I write that is not really edited is the little newsletter that I do, which goes straight from my word processor into print. And now the publisher, which is also my magazine publisher with Charisma Magazine in the States, has determined that he needs to at least read this before it goes into print, because I've been threatened to be sued a couple of times, and the lawyers, the barristers are out there always on me. And so he's determined that it would be a good idea for somebody to read this before it goes into print to make sure I'm not liabling somebody. But I work with editors all the time. And as a result, I know that nothing that I put on paper is sacred. Everything is open for adjustment. And I have learned to say this is right. It hurts sometimes, especially when you feel that you have just written the sentence that is going to change the world. And then they just strike it out completely. You've struggled with it for hours and hours, and then some pipsqueak of an editor comes along and just runs his blue pencil through it and says, toss that one. And that was my choice sentence, or my choice little story that they won't allow to go into print. But they always keep me out of trouble. And so I have learned to submit to this. How do I cope with criticism? I wrote a whole book on that called Coping with Criticism, which I need to go back and read again. I have a terrible time with it. Let me tell you what I do with book reviews. I've pretty well determined over the last several years that I'll not read these anymore. Because if they're very good, they go to my head. And I begin to believe that I am what I really am not. Somebody says this is the greatest thing that's ever been written. And then you begin to believe those lies. And if they're very bad, it sends me into a terrible fit of depression. And it takes me a while to come out. It makes me angry. And I get resentment and bitterness builds up. So I just don't read these things. I always feel that book reviews should never be read by authors. They are to be read by people who are going to buy the books. I prefer to submit myself for review to my editors. Because there I know that they are not going to reject me. They're just going to correct me. And there's a whole difference in being corrected without being rejected. That they have their purpose is to make me a better writer. And even though some of them are much younger than I am, they will see it from a different perspective. I've just gone through this. I write a regular column for Charisma magazine, which we call The Last Word, which appears on the last page of the magazine, which is now America's largest Christian magazine. And I struggle sometimes when a 30-year-old editor will call me on the phone and say, "We've just decided to take this paragraph out of your column." And I say, "You can't do that. You're taking the whole life out of the column." And we'll battle this thing back and forth. But usually they win on this. But I have just learned this is a lifestyle with me. I know that it's good for me to be corrected. And so I just live with this, that's all. It's painful, but I live with it. Okay. How much should you write? I think basically what you do is you get it to the... let me start this way. If you're going to write, always write for a particular audience and for a particular publication. If you're going to write for a magazine, study what that magazine is already using. And then write using the style that they would use. Don't submit poetry to a magazine that never prints poetry, because they're going to reject it just right offhand, that's all. Don't submit an adventure story to a magazine that only uses theological material. You start with a publisher, and you don't start with the whole book. I don't ever write anything on speculation. I would send them an outline of where I'm going to go, what the book is about. I would send them a sample chapter so they could see my style of writing. And then I would send them what we would call a query letter, which would be an overview. I would tell in 2 pages the story of what this book is about and emphasizing what the takeaway is for the book. And then I would submit that to a publisher. And they will do one of 2 or 3 things. They'll send you a little curt notice back that says this stuff is no good. They'll spill coffee all over your manuscript and lose it, and it'll be gone forever. Or you may get a note back saying, this has real possibilities. We would suggest that you go this way with it rather than this way, and we'll be glad to work with you. Or you may get one of those fabulous notes back that says, this is the finest thing we've read this year. Quickly send us the rest of your material. And here's a contract and an advance to go along with it. No, I think you're free to send it to a number of publishers. If you just send it to one, it may be months before you get it back. So send it to several. Go through the list of publishers. Go to your bookstore and find out who is publishing this kind of thing, and make multiple copies and send it to whoever. And hopefully, it's whatever rises to the surface. That's what you catch. We have a little process that we call chumming. If you've ever done any deep sea fishing in the tropical waters, and if you stand on the back of the boat before you actually put your line in the ocean, that you throw bait out all over the water, just toss it every place, and if fish rise to the surface to eat that bait, you know there's fish in there. If nothing rises to the surface, there's no sense in sitting there for hours at a time with your line in the water. And that's the way you determine if the fish are in that area, by tossing some free bait out there. And essentially that's what you do with a manuscript like this. You find out where they're biting, and then you go in that direction. We have run out of time. Oh, okay. Alan has asked me about Power for Living. We have, and I will not go into the story on this whole thing, but this was a book that I did for a foundation, a Christian foundation in the United States that approached me and asked me if I would do the book. They gave me a single fee for writing this book because they then gave it away on a campaign in the United States, basically done through television. Massive television promotion and ads in various secular magazines and newspapers, and they have given away approximately 12 million copies in the United States of this little book to people who have called in or have written in and said we wanted a copy of it. Now they've started the whole campaign here in the UK, I understand, and the last I heard was that they were approaching a million copies that have already been given away here in the UK. I don't know what the response is on that. I have received some letters already from people who have read the book and have received the Lord as a result of that. But it'll take a while for it to happen here because you don't have the same kind of media exposure. You can't use television here in the United States. Why we use television. And in fact, they even had an ad during our Super Bowl, which is like having a television ad during the middle of the World Cup. Procedures with some of the athletes standing up and saying, this book changed my life. If you'll call in to this particular toll-free number, why, we'll send you a copy of it. And
what responses have been in the States?
They've given away about 12 million copies. We've had right at a million people. There's a little card in the back that says, if you have read this book and have accepted Jesus Christ because of this, please tear out this card and send it in. And we'll send you some more material. We've had a million people who have read the book and have accepted Jesus as their Savior because of the book and have sent that little card in. Now, they estimate that that perhaps there's another two for every card that's sent in. But that's speculation. We don't know. We're estimating that 10% of the reading public in America has read the book. And upwards to 3 million people have received the Lord because of it. Which really makes it all worthwhile. Alan?
Okay, that's it, folks.